Usually we have a homegroom member talk for 5 minutes on sponsorship and introduce the main speaker, but tonight we have a guest speaker from York, Pennsylvania, Mike P. And he'll introduce the main speaker, Ben.
All right.
Hi, my name is Mike and I'm an alcoholic. How's everyone doing? When I got to Hanover, when I got sent to rehab, I got into the rehab and I saw a bunch of happy people coming in, like the people who work there. And they came in and would go through groups with us, and they seemed really happy. And I started taking advice from those people. There was two people, you know, that were really significant to my sobriety. And one of them suggested one night buying a big book. So I was at a meeting, and I bought a big book that night, and I took it back to the rehab with me. And he said, read the doctor's opinion. You know, he wasn't my sponsor or anything. He just told me to read it. So I read the doctor's opinion, and I went to him after a couple days. He's like, read it again. So I read the doctor's opinion again. And I tell you the truth, I got nothing out of it. It meant nothing to me at all. And he said to me one night, he's like, it's like algebra. It's like being taught algebra. Like you can read an algebra book all you want, and you're going to get nothing out of it. But you need that teacher there, someone to teach it to you and explain things and take you through it. So a couple weeks went by, because when you're in rehab, you know, you just kind of go along with the program. You don't really have any thoughts or decisions that you make. So a couple weeks went by, and I was at a meeting, and a kid came up to me afterwards, and I really wanted to get a sponsor, and I would go to meetings and not ask anybody. And I met a kid, so I asked him to be my sponsor. 2 weeks went by, I didn't put 100% into it, didn't call him every day. I'm like, I don't like this guy anymore. I don't want him to be my sponsor. So that kid in the rehab, the one who worked there, who told me to read the big book, I'm like, I want him to be my sponsor. Like, I felt a real connection with him. So then I was kind of in a debacle. I'm sitting in individual sessions, and I'm asking, like, the counselor, what do I do? And there's two people I want to be my sponsor. I asked both of them. I don't know what to do. So I eventually told one kid, I'm like, listen, you know, I was honest with him. It was, like, the first time I was honest in a long time. I'm like, I found someone else to be my sponsor, and I'm going to go with somebody else. So I chose this kid who's in AA, Mike Fowler, and he became my sponsor. And what was really important about making that decision, some people gave me advice, like, choose somebody who you want what they have. And it's not like I wanted, you know, he had money, I didn't want that, or a car, or anything like that. There was just something about him that I really related to, and I felt like I could trust him and be honest with him about everything that happened to me. So I chose him as my sponsor, and he took me through the steps. And his friends became my friends in AA. You know, his friends became the ones I remembered their names the quickest. His meetings became the meetings I went to. His home group became my home group. And without having him as a sponsor, you know, my beginnings of AA would have been completely different. It's just like it says in how it works. You know, you need to follow somebody through these steps. You can't do it on your own. And I chose to follow him, and it took me to where I am today, all because of a sponsor. I remember I was doing my fourth step, and you know, a lot of people tell this story. Like, they get to the fourth step, they get to like the third thing on the list, and the sponsor goes, "If there's anything you haven't told me, tell me." And there was obviously something. You know, there was something about being molested as a child, and I told them that, and I hadn't told anybody. My family, nobody knew about that, and it happened when I was like 11. And ever since I told him, you know, it allows me to say it tonight, just because I was able to tell somebody who I trusted, and that's like what I get out of sponsorship. It's like a newfound friendship in sobriety. And it's not like a father. It's not like somebody who tells you to do something. Or for me, at least. It's not like someone who tells me to do something, and if I don't do it, I feel bad, or I don't talk to that person the next day because I regret that I didn't do what they did. It's more like it's some type of companionship that you don't get mad at them, or you don't resent them. You just kind of listen to what they say and either choose to follow it or not. And today I use a sponsor when resentments crop up and when I'm in my head too much and I'm going crazy and I really need somebody to let some things out and talk to. And that's all I got. So I'm going to introduce Ben Weaver from White Rose, York, to speaking tonight.
Oh, I get plenty of time to think about what you're going to say, right? My name is Ben Weaver. I'm an alcoholic. I like you the way you guys run your meeting, definitely. It's just a little different than we do it down my way. I have a home group, the White Rose group, Friday nights. I know Steve and Jim and a lot of you guys. Jim very recently, I guess two Fridays ago, spoke down there. We actually are at 8 o'clock now, I'm sorry. We just recently moved churches. We do we do an hour speaker sharing his experience, his or her experience with the 12 steps through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, that's our group conscience. I have a sobriety date, September 30th of 2002. I have a very unique connection to this group in general. And I don't remember your name, but my buddy's sitting right back there, and I'll tell the story here real quick. What's your name, bud? Name with a tie?
Tom.
Yeah. Him and I think actually, I'm not sure if it was right at the same time, but I think we were new. I think we were new guys right about the same time in 2002. I had been in AA for a period of time, about 10 months. I had I'd been uncovered. I had become aware of the fact that I was alcoholic. I had taken action in the first 8 steps, and then the 10th, 11th, and 12th step. And to make a long story short, I had actually relapsed. I had put I'll get to this as I go through my story, but it was cool because I hadn't told my sponsor about it yet. And I called him out of the blue one Sunday at like 5 o'clock, and I was getting ready. It was either run off my porch, and this recovery house I was in New York at the time was very, very close to an area that has all the products that I like. And I had been frequenting that area the couple months before that. And it was either run off that porch or call my sponsor and tell him what had been happening. And it's very funny because he's a pilot, and he was planning on flying up here to speak. And it was really treacherous skies, I guess, and he wasn't flying. And then his secondary route would have been the turnpike from Maryland. And there's been like a big accident or something, and he couldn't go that way. So I called him, and he was right off the exit of I-83, right at my recovery house, 2 minutes from when I called him. And I didn't tell him what happened. I said, hey, you know, wherever you're going, I want to go. And we were supposed to talk about the 12th step, and it was him and 2 other experienced members were coming up here to Chatham, to Jim, you know, the sponsorship group. And we got in the car, and he's like, well, I got a couple guys to share their experience with the 12th step with you. And I said, well, why don't we talk about the first step? and they just, all 3 of them kind of looked at me like, you know, when you see people in AA that get active and, you know how to sound good when they talk and know the right things to say, like I definitely was, it was a shock to them that I had relapsed. But, you know, the whole way up here, I had 3 alcoholics sharing with one, which was very effective. And we got here, and at the time, you guys used to do a third step in the sanctuary over there. And, you know, I took my third step with you guys. It was really a cool experience. I haven't been back since, but I have a you guys have a real special place in my heart. But I almost always tell that story when I don't ever think about it unless when I'm speaking. But what was revealed to me through that chain of events was that God does not make difficult terms for those who seek him. That was, I didn't actually stay sober after that happened, but I don't necessarily, you know, in the third step in the Big Book, it talks about we alcoholics must be rid of selfishness above everything else. It must or it kills us. And that's even above alcohol. We must be rid of selfishness, in my opinion, the way it reads. And at that point, I was willing to acknowledge that that I was, you know, that my life, I was a self-will run riot. And that the way I managed my life in sobriety was no better than the way I managed my life drunk. And it was an awesome experience, and I definitely consider that my third step. Even though I didn't necessarily stay sober after that because I had some physical addiction that had to be broken, and you know, that went on to happen. But it was a very awesome moment in my sobriety to realize that all the chain of events and all the things that I could easily chalk up as coincidence kind of collided at one time, and God was there with an open hand to give me exactly what I needed. You know, I mean, who knows what could have happened if I would have run down the street that night. I don't know. But, you know, what I'm supposed to do when I share up here is tell you what my life was like as an active alcoholic, the series of events that got me to AA, and what my life is like now as a sober, an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And try to, through all that, I think my personal story about how I gained a relationship and a conscious contact with God will come through, because really that's the bottom line. You know, I really enjoyed that reading of the original manuscript. I really like that you guys do that. It was something I haven't read or heard in a long time. So, my story is very garden variety. It's boring the more times I tell it. You know, it's my drinking part. The more boring it gets. I couldn't have handled another second of it, of active alcoholism. I know I couldn't have. You know, I got here at 23. If I had the courage, I wouldn't have been living. If alcohol and drugs would have done what I ultimately wanted them to do, I wouldn't be living. You know, and I guess God had another plan. But I started off, I'm definitely not a victim of circumstance or a victim of bad genetic strains or bad heredity, because I come from a, you know, very loving family. You know, my mom stayed home with me and my sister. My dad worked. Any needs were always more than fulfilled. Any wants were there times 100. I was never abused in any way. You know, no sexual molestation when I was a kid. I had it really perfect. And if you would ask me, I had the worst family, the worst life. My parents were so strict and overbearing. Don't want me to spread my wings and fly. And I, you know, Mother Teresa could have been my mom. I would have been a neglected child. That's the bottom line. There is never enough. There was never enough of anything. And I always, all over my fourth step, when I wrote it down, there was authority figure after authority figure after authority figure. People trying to hold me down and tell me what to do. You know, my dad, you know, religion is the opiate of the masses. That was my battle cry. You know, just you name it. That was, it's just I had an alcoholic mind long before I ever drank. My dad's a big guy, no nonsense. And you know, I was scared to death of him as soon as I could start thinking. That's the way it was. My mom caught the lion's share and the brunt of all my shenanigans, and she went to great measures to try to hide it from my dad, because, you know, I think she was scared of him too. I mean, he would never do anything physically. That's not the way he is. He's just a man of enormous moral character. And, you know, I just felt the moral scale. I heard a buddy of mine speak a couple Mondays ago down in York, and he talked about the scale that he had inside of him. And when he would meet somebody, you know, whether it was anybody really, but like a counselor or a therapist, the moral scale would always adjust, and he would feel so much less than or so much inferior to. And, you know, he would meet somebody else, and the scale would swing the other way, and how much better he was, you know, these dirt bags. That was, you know, I grew up in a very kind of a strange area. It's Amish country in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. You have a upper middle class aspect, and you have the Amish, and then you have the farmers, and then you have the river rats and the dirt bags. And the people that really I fit in with the best. There's no doubt about it. It wasn't necessarily how I was raised, but you know, at heart, in spite of all my efforts to cover everything up, I'm just basically a redneck. You know, that's about it. I did not know how to live before Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have any class. I looked at people as really pawns in my game. I mean, just because I could do it nicely and with dignity, and you know, I could be virtuous, just because I had that in me, doesn't change me from the guy coming in off the corner of the street. There's no doubt about it. But because of my circumstances, because of my parents being strict, and because I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home by any means, my drinking career didn't kick off nearly as soon as it should have, in my opinion. But I'm not like a, by any means, wonderful at anything, but I could, sports, anything I would do, I would always be good enough, definitely not to be the last one picked on the team, and definitely good enough to, if I wasn't starting, definitely play a lot with no practice, no effort, and that's definitely the way I liked it. So my first kind of ticket, my first ticket to success was through sports. And I played baseball and basketball and golf. And, you know, like I said, I was relatively good at them, but I didn't have to. I never had the determination to put much effort in. If I didn't feel like it, I wasn't going to do it. And that's kind of the story of my life. If I didn't feel like doing it, in that any given moment, it just wasn't happening. So, but that was how I was introduced to the party scene. I hung out with the older guys, and actually, when I really first started drinking, I had quite a few cousins that were older than me, and I would be kind of the court jester of the parties, the guy that would come and would drink a couple beers. And I'm sure I poured way more out than I actually drank when I was young, but I'd pass out in the middle of the floor and they'd shave my pubes off and color me with markers, and I loved it. I loved being the center. I loved all of it. I like a good speaker that I hear. I can't remember which one, but he talks about from the first time he got the effect of alcohol, the first time the drink worked, he could have as much stepped away from that, left the drink alone, and never drank again, as much as he could fly to the moon. It just wasn't happening. It was the answer to everything that bothered me, all my fears, doubts, and insecurities, and fears, and self obsession. It was for sure the answer. I think I really started getting twisted up mentally when I could, like 12 or 13 years old, when I could really start forming conscious thoughts. I could start measuring myself up against others, because, like I said, I lived a pretty sheltered childhood. I mean, we hung out with family, we hung out with family, and I walked the line in school. I got really good grades through middle school, and then coming into my freshman year, I guess, of high school is when it really started. And to tell you the God's honest truth, I never had any. I mean, I blamed it for a long time on living like the sheltered lifestyle, but I think my mom dressed me till I was 16 years old. I had no clue. I used to go to she would pick my haircuts. I'm sure she was doing me a favor, but you can look at some of my old school pictures. It's highly embarrassing. My fiance just rides me nonstop for that. But I was just an awkward kid. I've always been really pale, and I was really skinny and pale, and real dark black hair, and always had big huge feet. But I was really skinny and short. I mean, I didn't hit my growth spurt till 10th grade. I'm a grade, but I was just an awkward kid. And the drink was so needed. It really was so needed. It kind of made all the pieces fit and made it all work and made it just okay to be me. And more than anything, I started believing the lies I told everybody else about my escapades and the double life that we try to live. And but I had a blast drinking. There's no doubt about it. I had way way more fun than I ever had problems. It's just that the problems got so heavy. It got out of control very, very fast. But through high school, it was a real good time. I didn't pay any prices for it, other than because my mom would cover up my scrapes from my dad. And we live in the country, so there's no cops anywhere near anything. And house parties and throwing a couple tires on the fire out in the woods and the farms, and it was awesome. But it started coming time to if the plan was, that was kind of dictated to me, was that when I graduated high school, on to college I went. And that was never really anything I gave a conscious thought, except for one time my dad told me, he said that college is going to be the best years of your life. Make sure you enjoy it and take advantage of it. And of course, to me, that means I just go party as absolutely hard as I possibly can. So that was the vision I had to set up my going into college. When really he meant, and now I understand in hindsight, he meant that you're going to have responsibilities. You're going to, I'm not going to support your dumb ass your whole life. And, you're going to have to find a job after college. And so, go enjoy, sow some wild seeds, but enjoy it. He had it all set up so I could go to school. I didn't have to worry about money. I didn't have to work. He told me all I had to do was get a 2.0, which is, stretching it for me, but shouldn't have been stretching it. But, when that's like the last thing on my mind was an education, that's for sure. I was just too twisted up and confused. But I quit all my sports, all the sports except for golf my senior year. I like golf because you got out of school early and you go out in the woods and smoke pot. But I quit the baseball team, I quit the basketball team. I was supposed to be a starter. My coaches just looked at me dumbfounded when I told them I wasn't playing. Like, they didn't understand. It was just things that were getting in the way of the life I wanted to live. Barely graduated high school. Did very well on my SATs. Hung over and half blasted still from the night before, but I took them and did did good enough to get into really pretty much any school that I, with the grade point average as low as I had, that I would want to. And I got, I looked in this Playboy magazine at my cousin's thing, and I didn't realize it was from like 1984, and this was in the 90s, but it had a little state school in western Pennsylvania that was number three party school in the nation at the time, supposedly. And again, this is in the 80s, but it just was coincidence. It was the first package, you know, when you're a senior, you get all this just bombarded with college packages, and I sent it off, and you know, they accepted me right away. I mean, if you had a heartbeat and you could read, you could get in, basically. And I got in, and it was just like, that's how the whole summer. I did my work for the summer after high school. I got accepted into college. We got a plan. We got a game plan. So I just partied it up and started getting into harder and harder things. And, you know, needless to say, when my dad took me for that five-hour ride to this godforsaken area of western Pennsylvania and dropped me off in this town that I knew no one, I had all the fears and doubts and insecurities, and the madness was on me. Very fortunately, I was able to track down people just like me immediately, or who knows what would have happened. But about 2 weeks into my stay at Slippery Rock, we got our dorm room got raided by the campus police. There was like 14 of us in there. We had a huge party in the dorm going with all, you know, they took two garbage bags of paraphernalia out, and it was, you know, I always say, I don't know if it was the grace of God or if it was a stoner policeman, but we never heard anything back from that. It was the CA of the dorm put all of us, I was, you know, people always talk about, like, you know, the virtuous, you know, the people take the rap for others. And I was trying to pawn off all the blame on all the other freshmen in the room with me, you know. It wasn't me, it was there, because I was just scared to death of going home to my dad and having to tell him about this. But I got put on 1 year disciplinary probation. That was it. You know, there was a lot of, lots and lots of drugs that they hauled out of there. But it was a near miss. This is my first exposure to anybody confronting me about my drinking. We had this like drug and alcohol counselor or something like that at the college that sat us down. And basically what he said is, he said, just go into the woods. Don't do it in the dorm. You know, it's a very rural area. Just go into the woods and nobody's going to catch you. He kind of pulled us aside and wink, wink, gave us a little elbow and said, just take it deep in the woods. So for that next semester, me and my buddies, you know, we lived in the woods. I had this. I'm not bullshitting you when I say this, and I have a lot of experience with living in the woods. But I had this really lame, like canvas burlap jacket that was looked like a big pot plant. And they called me the Bud Man, and that's what I always just smelled like. And you know, we dug a hole in the woods and threw our cans of Keystone Ice in there. We built a gravity bong that we kept up in the woods. I mean, that's where I stayed for the next entire semester. It was absolute madness, and we started taking enormous amounts of LSD, and you know, I really lived in a parallel universe. It was crazy, but it was a lot of fun. But it was very strange to come back home for the summer with this with just horrible grades and dropping out of all my classes. And you know, I didn't look like the person that my dad dropped off at school, that's for sure. And he gave me the silent treatment for an entire year after that. Like I didn't even exist. Like I wasn't even a fly on the wall. When he basically sat me down and said, you know, when did you start doing drugs? One night when I came home real late at night, and, you know, and he just, like I was a scum of the earth. He just totally didn't even acknowledge my existence for a year. And that was way worse than him kicking my butt. It really was, especially when you have that moral barometer in your heart at all times, already kicking the crap out of yourself and wondering what the problem is, but nowhere near ready to talk to anybody about it. There was, you know, I just figured it was a phase, it was something I would grow out of, but that wasn't the case. I'm very resilient and very protective of alcohol, so I really pulled it together. I put a lot of effort in. I found other substances allowed me to stay awake and be more alert instead of always wanting to eat and fall asleep and be lazy. And I got very heavy into that. And I started, really doing excelling in school. It was weird. I mean, I started getting really good grades and started making the dean's list. And I got in all kinds of clubs. I got in, you know, Planet Keepers and Earth Watchers, and I got in the Honor Society for English and Geography. I got involved in all this stuff. I started, like I was telling the guys on the way up, I started writing papers for people to make money on the side just to support my habit. I started tutoring. started embezzling money from the state system of higher education is probably a better way to put it, but I just, you know, it was like, I just really realized how important it was to me. I couldn't stand the thought of going back home and being under my parents' whip again, and, you know, I really thought I loved the freedom. I was touring all over the East Coast with following bands around, and I just was in search of the eternal buzz. I had it slapped on, license plate slapped on the back of my car, and that was the truth. We were in search of the eternal buzz. And it really didn't start getting bad. You know, it didn't start getting alcoholic loneliness bad for another year or two. And when that starts hitting, that's when you know, when it hits in your heart and you know that there's an answer. That's the greatest relief from that isolation, you know, that dark abyss that I started to slip into, where when I woke up in the morning, I felt like it's going to be the same today as it was yesterday. You know, it's how's this ever going to change? I started thinking little stuff like that. You know, is it always going to be like this? You know, I have to do that today again. And this is all while I was living under this weird, this facade of like the hip, you know, I was a hippie, and you know, that was like the facade I was living under. But And I had a lot of friends and a lot of people around me at all times, but I just felt so alone. I felt so isolated. It was crazy. I wouldn't talk to my parents for months at a time because I just didn't know what I was going to say. I mean, I would basically send letters asking for more money with all these stories I would come up with. And alcoholism, really, the delusion of alcoholism doesn't just affect the alcoholic. The delusion of alcoholism definitely affects those who love us the most, and they're trying to deny it. Either they're in delusion of the fate of the loved one. And, you know, I really took my mom along for the ride. My mom and my grandmother, I really took them hard along for the ride. But, you know, what started getting my attention was when I would like drive over a bridge and I would start thinking about how easy it would be to drive off, or I'd be hiking through the woods and I would start looking for higher, you know, start kind of peeking for higher cliffs and saying that would probably do the trick. And this all just started happening like naturally. Like that's just the way alcoholism kind of progresses. It just happens naturally. You know, I do believe that the spiritual disconnection I have, for whatever reason, my mind interprets that pain and says, "We got to stop this. This has to end. I can't feel. You know, you can't take the blame for everything you did and you're doing to these people. There's no way. It's this guy's fault. It's his fault. I was neglected, or, you know, I couldn't even come up with any excuses. That started happening very young for me. I started, you know, my early 20s, I started realizing, before I even turned 21, I started realizing that there wasn't really anybody else to blame. And, you know, I would get little glimmers. I mean, I would bounce back. I'd come up with a plan. I'd pull myself together. I'd get through it. I'd get another report card with a bunch of A's, when really I just knew what classes to take. I knew what professors didn't take attendance. I knew what professors used the same curriculum, and I could buy the stuff off other people from the system. I mean, I just knew how to manipulate the system. That's the bottom line. But, you know, it just... that's the only way I can really describe it. The darkness really started to envelop me, and the emptiness and the disconnection that was there that I drank to escape started to come while I was drinking. You know, and I had this one summer where I said, okay, I mean, I know nobody, I really know no examples of people that are living, managing their life and living a successful life as a heroin addict. So, you know, I got off of that. I mean, I could put that together, but you're never, ever, ever. My sponsor says it so perfectly, I'll never be able to quote it, but, you know, I could give the drugs, you know, I could give that away, but you're never taking a drink. What do I have if you take the drink? I have nothing. There was no way I could ever imagine life without drinking. You know, I see my dad and his buddies, and, you know, Albert and I grew up together. He came down with me, and, you know, they would sit around, they'd drink a couple beers, and, you know, it just seemed like the sun was shining the perfect way, and they were just, you know, hooping it up, and it was perfect. You know, they weren't out of control. It was just the rite of passage. It's just what a non-alcoholic drinks like. And that was the delusion. You know, that was the delusion that our big book says on page 30 has to be smashed. And when I was fortunate enough to read that, it had already been smashed. I'm very grateful for that. But that's a little bit ahead in the story. So what happened was, what happened to get me here was, I was not invited. I couldn't live with my parents' house anymore. I couldn't live in my grandmother's house anymore. She's like the patron saint of lost causes. Like there's, you know, if there's a person who's lived a perfectly spiritual life, you know, I'm a pretty biased opinion. I'll admit that right off the bat. If you asked her, she would never fess up to it because she has natural humility. But she would be it, you know. And she even said, she said the hardest thing in her life she ever had to do, and she was a widow for 50 years, raised two kids. Her husband died. There was a huge age difference. They died very young. She was born during the Great Depression. She said the hardest thing she ever had to do was kick her grandson out of her life, you know, and that was me. So, and when I went to make amends to her for it, it was crazy because she said, you know, you didn't hurt me, you hurt you. I just couldn't watch you hurt yourself anymore. That's why I did it. You know, it wasn't that you were hurting me at all. You know, she has a relationship with a loving God. She knew that God had me, you know, right in the palm of his hand the whole time, but, you know, she just couldn't bear to watch it. So I ended up, my first ever that I can remember consciously, I used to say prayers when I was little. I used to say, I can almost remember verbatim, I used to say, God, please grant me a long, happy, disease-free life. That used to be the prayer I would say. Because I just always thought that I was going to suffer from some horrible, debilitating illness and die, and I was so scared to death of being young. So that was the only prayer I said, and I said that until I was 12 or 13 years old. And then, you know, other things took the place of God's the natural order of God in my life. You know, and that was, my heroes were like Kurt Cobain and Jerry Garcia, and, you know, that was what, live hard, burn out young, and that was what my battle cry was. When really underneath of it all, I was just a scared little kid still. But I was in Susquehanna State Park, actually. I had nowhere to go. I was, you know, homeless. I don't have the street smarts to live in the city. But I cried out to a God I didn't trust, and that I had been slandering and bashing and getting into long, windy arguments with people about how, you know, God was for the pitiful and for the weak. You know, and I had no reason to say any of that. It's just the way alcoholism made me think. You know, and that, when there was nothing left, nowhere left to go, no, I didn't have that one last plan to come up with anymore. I didn't have any more lies to tell myself that I thought would work. I went naturally to God. And I really had a very powerful experience with feeling like God was just picked me up and I had hope, you know, because I acknowledged it. You know, the honesty to the gut level honesty of what was ailing me. And, you know, I ended up in the psych unit of Langston Regional Hospital. And I was sitting there, and my mom and my sister actually came to take me to intake. And I rolled up my sleeve, and I was, you know, like I said, I'm very pale to begin with. And I just had track marks up and down my arm. And I looked down my arm, and it just looked like it was a skeleton. Like, my skin was so pale you could see through it. I was malnourished. I hadn't been eating, you know. And my mom was sitting right beside me, and she looked, you know, this is the woman that brought me into the world. I'm the apple of her eye. I'm her firstborn. The joke was I was always the golden boy. That was my nickname growing up because my mom loved me so much. And, you know, I looked over at her, and the look on her face wasn't disgust. It was guilt. She's like, what did I do to cause this? And I never wanted her to put her in that position ever, ever again. I was so tormented with myself that I did, because I knew at that point, I knew that there was no excuse for the way I lived. There was no excuse. There was no one to blame other than me. You know, I could see everything that the first three steps were trying to tell me before anybody ever sat me down with them. I could see that my problems were my own making. And I knew it to the core of my soul and the core of my being. You know, and God took me on the ride. I went from, I'd never been exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous before. I'd done a couple psych units type of things, try to dry out real quick before I had to come home and take a drug test for a job or something like that in Western PA. But I had never been in an AA meeting. I'd never seen, I hadn't even seen 28 Days or Phil's Story, or I hadn't seen anything. I had no idea. I'd heard like about AA, but I had no preconceived notions, no preconceived ideas. So I consider myself one of the very fortunate ones that was handed the message that, you know, this group carries and my home group carries, and the message you can find. You know, people go years. You know, my sponsor went 10 years. You know, he wasn't ready to hear it, but he didn't hear it either. You know, the window of, you know, the desperation of the new man and the solution being handed to him, those two things didn't add up for him for 10 years, and sobriety nearly killed him. And, you know, I didn't have that experience. I had a strong message, not carried by words, but carried by actions. It brought right to my doorstep, laid right at my feet when I was in rehab. A lot of the people that I still run around with to this day that are still sober carried the message of Alcoholics Anonymous into that institution. You know, that I knew that the groups that I was sitting through and the therapy sessions, I mean, I knew that crap wasn't going to work. I mean, I don't mean to belittle that at all. I'm just saying from my personal experience, I knew that lack of love was never my problem. I knew that my self-esteem was insane and crazy, but I knew that that wasn't my problem. Somehow, intuitively, I knew that. I knew that my actions were my problem. The things I was actually doing were my problem. I just somehow knew it. So, I mean, the groups and the therapy sessions, I just couldn't wait for them to be over. It made me uncomfortable looking myself in the mirror and sit across from people in the rehab and tear each other down. You know, it just made me completely uncomfortable, and I didn't see how it could be effective therapy at all. But when these guys would come in, and you know, I didn't know if it was the fact that they got to drink the real coffee with the caffeine, or if it was, or what it was, but you know, they were just smiling. It was like they looked forward all day, whatever their trial, whatever their tribulations were throughout the day, they looked forward to coming in there and talking to us. And you know, I sure as hell look forward to them coming in too. You know, it was natural laughter, and I hadn't laughed for so long. I hadn't felt hope. I remember just a little slight flicker of hope I started to have in my heart as these guys were just, you know, they would tell crazy, insane, wild war stories about shooting dope out of toilets and mud puddles and, you know, drinking away families and drinking away jobs and careers and businesses and going to jail for 20 years, and they were just cracking up and laughing. And, you know, I mean, I didn't do any of that stuff. I never even had a job. You know, I worked for my uncle, but I know I cost him way more money than I ever made it. And I embezzled money from my college, and I embezzled money from my parents and sold pot. And that's all I ever did. I didn't ever have a job, so I couldn't destroy any of that stuff. But I knew at 23 years old, I felt like a zero with the edges rubbed off, and I didn't want to live anymore. You know, I knew that much. And I knew that I found out that I knew that other stuff wasn't my problem, because about 7 or 8 days into that institution, all that stuff wore off, and I thought I'd be feeling better. I felt way worse. You know, I felt like I was in, you know, eighth grade all over again. You know, how do I measure up? Like worrying obsessively what the other people, other losers in the rehab, were thinking of me and how I measured up against them. You know, but I knew that sobriety was my problem. So I got to fast forward a little bit here. So I ended up in New York, Pennsylvania, in a recovery house. You know, I was following direction. The counselor in the rehab was actually a member of AA, and he laid his job on the line every day in there, because he would talk to us about what you need to do when you get out of here. He would, you know, show us the outline for the fourth step. You know, he would talk about the history of AA, and you know, he would carry an AA message in the rehab, and he eventually got fired for it. But you know, I'm very grateful when he told me he was going to be my sponsor, and I got out of there. And I just had that, I had the willingness, and I had the hope. I had the willingness, and I had the hope. I wasn't quite honest yet. I wasn't ready to be honest, and alcohol beat that out of me after 10 months of sobriety and 10 months of me managing my own life. And I really, anytime anybody talks to me now, to this day, about what step I'm on, or what's the critical step, or what step are you working on, I like to stay far away from the word work, because I don't think the steps are work at all when you have a first step in place. I always tell them it's step one. It's always step one. It's a step I always need to stay on. And the reason that is because I have an experience of knowing that when I'm not drinking, I don't know when I'm going to start again. And when I'm drinking, I don't know when I'm going to stop. And I drank. I had that knowledge. I knew that God loved me. I knew that I had everything in place, but I balked on my ninth step. I totally balked on my ninth step. I started looking at my life and saying, after 10 months of sobriety, I had a shoebox full of money because I was too scared to go to the bank because I thought they'd take it from me. And I was the president of the recovery house, and I was taking the food money and just putting it in my pocket. You know, I was sponsoring guys. My sponsor said, you know, you're not doing it the way I showed you. And I said, well, you know, I read in here, do it this way. I saw these guys doing it this way. I was running my own life. And I started taking credit. I said, man, my family was inviting me back. You know, the wounds that I thought were cut so deep, you know, without ever making amends, they were healed like instantly, you know, because unconditional love of your family, doesn't matter what you do to them. They're just like volunteers. They keep coming back for more. You know, they hop in the front line to go to war every time for you. but I looked at my life and I said, look, a wonderful job I'm doing. You know, look at what Ben did with his life. I don't need AA. You know, I didn't say that consciously, but it's just like Tom talks about. He says, everybody in this world has a boat. Every single individual is out in this big body of water and has a boat. The alcoholic has a hole in his boat. He's sinking. He's drowning. And he's fighting. And right before I took my last breath, I cried out to God for help. And he dropped me a pump. It fit perfectly in that hole. And that pump was the 12 steps. And I pumped that pump with everything I had, because I had nothing else to do. No other hope. And I pumped it, and I started floating up with everybody else. I had a sponsor. I had a relationship with a loving God. I knew God loved me. I knew you could feel God's love. You know, it was an unbelievable spiritual experience I had my first trip through the steps. And I still didn't stay sober because I started managing my own life in sobriety. Pretty soon I was floating up with everybody else. I looked around and said, I want a coat of paint on my boat. You know, I want to have a couch in my boat, a little refrigerator. I want a little girl on my boat or two little girls in my boat. I want an education. I want a plaque to hang on my boat. Pretty much I filled my boat up with so much shit that I forgot the one thing that gave me life, the 12 steps. And I started to drown and started to sink. And what the danger of that is I can, my delusional mind can look at that and say, I tried AA and it doesn't work. That's what'll happen. You guys will be telling me, come back. You know, you were doing so good. My parents, you know, you were doing so good. Everything, you know, it works for you guys, but it doesn't work for me. I tried it. It doesn't work. When really, the reality was, it was working awesome. It was working perfectly. Just like it will, guaranteed, for any man, woman, or child who tries the 12 steps, alcoholic or not, it'll work. You'll get a relationship with God. It worked for me. But I started taking credit for it. And I started telling myself I didn't do it. Or I did it and it didn't work. When really, I didn't do it because I ain't clean house. Bottom line, you can't, you know, in AA, what we do is we don't put a brand new pretty roof and siding on a rotten house, a house with a rotten foundation. You know, we rip the foundation out, destroy it, cast it out without regret, and build from the ground up. And that's what I did. I just made a rotten house look nice and pretty, you know. But now that leads me to the story of when the first time I was up here. You know, in spite of, and I've seen it a million times over in my attempts to try to do our 12-step and try to help people, is I've seen people who have had so many chances, me included, and God will continue to give them chance after chance. Every single time, everything will fall into place. Guys with 12 felonies will get a career job. You know, people who, you know, diseases will just go into remission and disappear. You know, people will go through these crazy surgeries and be on their deathbed, and everything, all of a sudden, you know, they're making $100,000 a year again, and all, you know, it's just unbelievable the love that God has for all his kids when you sit back and witness it. And, you know, we screw it up. That's what we do. That's what I do. We screw it up. You know, we screw it up. And by graceful mercy, eventually, if I've had a couple of very dear friends, by graceful mercy, you know, God said, all right, come up here a little bit closer to me. Come home, and you can help me out up here because you're not doing very good there in the flesh, you know. But that's it. That's a ticket. That's what AA is, man. It is. If I thought, you know, my sponsor told me this very early on. He said, if I thought me and you sitting down and deciphering your problems and figuring out a solution or a new plan for living or a way to pull yourself up by your bootstraps would work, I would sit here with you for hours and try. But reality is, I know that the quicker we get out of the problem, which is in between your ears, and get you into the solution, which is you trying to help somebody like I'm helping you, the better off both of us will be. And that's what I did when I managed to limp back in here in September of 2002, getting sober again, getting 12-step by a bunch of guys that you were trying to help is very hard on the pride, you know. Getting guys that come in before you or come in after you, you know, you see them and their lives coming together, and it was just, you know, and I had a girlfriend too. We had the same sobriety date. She's still sober, so am I. I don't recommend it, but it's my experience. You know, my sponsor always says, he said that people, you know, where this idea of wait a year to get into a relationship come from? There's people with 40 years who have no business being in a relationship. there's people with 1 month that probably have a lot to give. You know, and of course, I don't say that to new guys. I usually don't say it for podium either, because we can grab that one little thing out of everything I said and say, okay, that guy said that you can get in a relationship after a month, but that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that there is no time. You know, time. Keith Lewis talks about the linear time and the cyclical time, or he talks about man's time and God's time. You know, how, you know, in man's 50 years in man's time seems so long that people come in here when they're 50 years old, I've destroyed my life, I wasted it, you know, shame myself, how am I ever going to live? When in God's time, it just took 50 years for you to get ready to actually live. You know, we just have it all backwards and twisted, and our old ideas are, you know, we have to let go absolutely of our old ideas, and I believe I have to let go of all my old ideas, and I don't do that well at all. I move my feet with an open mind, and And I try to allow God to, I try to rely on God and allow Him to, you know, manage my life and call the shots and let me know what's good and bad and right and wrong and what I'm supposed to be doing and what I'm not supposed to be doing. And I do that by, I do that through prayer and meditation. And I do that through trying to help others. And I do that from actively being sponsored. You know, my sponsors become more and more and more like my friend, just like the guys that I sponsor have become more and more like my friends and my compatriots on the journey. I know that God's the ultimate sponsor. I know that it's not me. I know that I have an experience, that I'm an example of what Alcoholics Anonymous does, because, you know, a drunk, hopeless, pathetic excuse for a human being can have a life that I wouldn't trade with anybody. None of it, not for a second. You know, when I got to AA, I would have traded places with anybody, absolutely anybody. I would have been anywhere but me doing anything what I was doing. And just through the process of staying in the first step, I don't mean you sit on the first step, but I mean everything. You know, if a guy comes to me and says I'm having a problem, or they're balking on their eighth step or their fourth step, you know, their problem's not with four, it's not with three, it's not with two, it's with their first step. They're not done with their way. You know, that was my experience. I was not ready to let go, absolutely. I was not ready to surrender. That's not something anybody else can ever give you. That's not something that's why it's such a priceless gift. That even after I had to give the desperation that I came in with in 2002, even though I drank after that, I never lost sight of that. You know, I still held on to that gift, you know, and I tried to screw it up. I really did with everything I could. I tried to do everything that everybody said not to do. But, you know, God still, God loved me in spite of all that. You know, we're not powerful enough to offend God. I don't have the resources to understand God. I don't have the resources to figure God out. I believe if God wanted us to figure Him out, somebody way better than me would have done a long time ago. It hasn't been done yet, you know. And I don't know what really gives me the right to think that I need to understand God. You know, I believe, like my sponsor does, that if I try to understand God or put labels and definitions and, you know, play by play, sometimes I'm like, all right, God's probably going to do this in this situation in my life, or, oh, this is starting to happen, so that's probably God's will. You know, this is probably the way it's going to lead. Every time I do that, it just cuts off how big God can be in my life. If God is A to Z in the alphabet, when I try to do that, I might make Him C to R, and I miss out on all that other aspect of what, you know, what God is. So I try to keep an open mind, and I did go back and clean up my past in the ninth step. You know, and I tell you what, the ninth step and the 12th step for me were the ones that really, you know, the ones that really were really the tickets to freedom. The ninth step, looking at my dad no longer with such fear and horror. You know, I don't mean horror, but looking at him is just like, I was scared of him. I thought he was so morally superior. You know, I started looking at him as just a brother, you know, as a best friend. You know, my mom, who, same story. You know, my sister, those were the hard ones for me. The financial ones weren't as difficult as the emotional ones that I had to sit down with my people who really love me and that I have to continue to show up for, because really the initial amends is pretty overrated. If I'm going to make amends and still live like an asshole, it's not really doing Alcoholics Anonymous a lot of justice. But, you know, some of the what my life's like now, Alcoholics Anonymous is, you know, it sounds cheesy to say it, but it's the highlight of my life. It's what I look forward to every day. I love everything else in my life, don't get me wrong, but I love the chances to spend time with other alcoholics and to sit down and share my experience with them and listen to other people sharing their experience with somebody else. And just, you know, we have a lot of fun. We play basketball, we go to boxing matches, we just have fun. Happy sobriety. That's what you get. A purpose. A usefulness. You know, not necessarily things I thought I wanted. I really just wanted, you know, I did truly want the pain to stop. I wanted to be able to laugh. I thought it'd be okay to be comfortable in my own skin. I figured it had to take a hell of a lot of medication to get me there. But I was willing to do whatever it took. And I found out that everything the oak tree needs is in the acorn. You know, everything that we need to be happy, joyous, and free, God already gave me. It's already here. It's already part of the package. It's my birthright. I just had to, you know, I always told my mom, I said, you know, I could see the two paths. I could see the right path and wrong path. I just don't have the power to do the right thing. This is the way I put it before I was educated and understood it. The need to power was not there. I did not have it, because for whatever reason I had this spiritual malady, this spiritual disconnection. No, I don't believe it's, I don't personally for me call it a disease. I call it a condition of my existence that, you know, I'm allergic to alcohol. I have a spiritual sickness that, and a mental obsession. If I treat the spiritual first, the mental and the physical always work out. And as a result of doing that and having a sponsor, that, you know, I've always been sponsored and I've always actively tried to sponsor people, and coming up on 7 years, I've been engaged to the woman I love that I've been loyal to the entire time. And I don't say that for any reason other than the fact that that's something I didn't know was possible either, you know, to wake up next to your best friend, to have to be a father. It's another thing I thought was impossible. But that came one day. I was off running around for work. It was before I had money for a cell phone. It just so happened the circumstances worked out perfectly that I got back to the office in time, and I found out she was going into labor, and I was driving down the hill. You know, and alcoholics like myself are very grandiose. I'm a legend in my own mind at all times. I was thinking, you know what, right before my son was born, I was thinking, you know, I always thought I would do something great with my life. That's the way my mind was going. You know, just one of those reflective moments. And I said, you know, I think that being a father is going to be it. My dreams got realistic, simplified, and perfect. And it's been the greatest thing I've ever experienced, the love I feel. A lot of my understanding of the unconditional love has come from being a father and trying to do it with spiritual principles and making mistakes all the time. Believe me, I do nothing remotely close to perfectly, and you don't have to. That's just another form of bondage. But I have that. I actually finished my first college degree in sobriety in 2005, and now I'm going back for a teacher's certification because I want to be a first or second grade teacher. I haven't decided which one yet. I never knew what I wanted to be when I grew up. I never could envision anything I could possibly do and be happy with. That was alcoholism. That was the problem. But you know, it's taken me a while to figure it out with God's help, but it's been revealed to me, and that's the path I'm on now. So you said, you know, I talked to a guy one time, and I'll finish up with this because I'm running over. But he wasn't an AA, but he's a guy who's oh, it's not important. But he said, you set your dreams and you set your goals so high that there's no possible way you could ever get there on your own. And then when you get there, and when you're relishing in that, and you're in amazement, you'll realize that a power greater than yourself is what you got you there. So thanks for letting me share.